Okay, so we're going to talk about the three higher trainings and how to get out of samsara, this big fat mess. Okay, so, you know, if reading the news helps you generate renunciation, then that's the right way to read it. If reading the news makes you depressed, then you need to do more meditation on love and compassion and renunciation. And, you know, even if you could do abracadabra and make everything change overnight, would that solve all the problems in the world? No, because as long as people have ignorance, anger, and attachment, rebirth in samsara is going to keep going. So you can, you know, make lots of legislative deals, lots of international treaties, but unless sentient beings' minds change, you know, creating the karma that causes suffering to oneself and others continues. So we have to, that's very important to always keep in mind. Okay. Yeah. And especially, well, maybe I better wait this. I was going to get into the talk, but maybe we better do our chanting first, and then I will give you a, yeah. And, yeah, I didn't remember to send out my little list of terms, but on the other hand, none of you reminded me to. So, okay. So, important to remember that we're sitting in the presence of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Yeah, with Buddhas and Bodhisattvas as far as the eye can see. And sentient beings surrounding us also as far as the eye can see. And we are fortunate enough to have met the three jewels and have the opportunity to learn and practice and take refuge and generate bodhicitta. So let's feel our fortune and want to include everybody else in that fortune. So it's very helpful to remind ourselves often of why we're in samsara. Yeah. And, you know, the root is attachment to I and mine. And if we look in our lives, we can see how that attachment to I and mine confines us. Yeah. So, well, I, okay, but what about mine? You know, my reputation. Yeah, what people think about me, if people like me, if people love me, do I belong? Yeah, am I smart enough? Am I good looking enough? You know, what does society think of me? And how much time and energy we spend worrying about our reputation and what actually is a reputation. Yeah, we worry about it, but what actually are we worried about? So this is something to really contemplate. Yeah, what is a reputation? Is it made of atoms and molecules? Can you see it or hear it or smell it or taste it or touch it? How do you know it exists? Where does it exist? Yeah. So really take some time with your reputation. And then the other big thing we're attached to is this body, you know, and to see, okay, you know, how we look, but that's comparatively minor. What really grabs us is the fear of this body getting hurt, the fear of the body getting sick, the fear of the body getting old and dying. Yeah. And so, you know, we lug this corpse around 24/7. Yeah, remember the Chan, what do you call it? You know, like koan of who is lugging this corpse around. Well, yeah, we're lugging it around. Why are we so attached to it? What is it? Yeah. Why are we so attached? Is it the body we're attached to? The sensations from the bodies? What's going on there? Yeah. Okay, so again, to really spend some time and look at that and how these attachments to the mind of my reputation, yeah, which includes, you know, your love life and what other people think of you and, you know, blah, blah, your promotion in business and so on, and attachment to the body, to this hunk of vegetable goo. Yeah. Somebody put a bunch of vegetable goo out there. We wouldn't go, oh, I want to live in that. But that's what we're doing. Yeah. We're living in recycled vegetable goo. Okay. So, where we were in the book, talking about generating serenity and concentration, and we were talking about the different objects that in the Pali tradition that they can use to generate serenity and the meditative absorptions. So we got to the bottom of page 266. We'll start at the top of 267. Okay. And 266 was introducing the topic of developing serenity on the four Brahma-viharas, or the four immeasurables. Okay. So this is what a lot of you are meditating on in your retreat. So it's very timely. There's some instruction in here, which I'll go through today. If you look in volume 5, In Praise of Great Compassion, there's more instruction about the four immeasurables. Yeah. So it isn't just like, oh, I love everybody. You know? Yeah, like I said the other day, it's so nice, so easy to love everybody when your belly is full, when you live in a nice place, then the temperature is okay, and, you know, the people around you are nice. Yeah, then it's so easy to love the world. Yeah, but the moment, you know, somebody leaves something around in your environment and makes it messy or you trip over it, then your love for the world is out the window. Yeah. So what are we exactly trying to generate? Yeah, so we'll get into that in a minute. Let's start reading. So the four Brahma-viharas are practiced in conjunction with mindfulness and are used to cultivate samadhi. So here mindfulness does not mean secular mindfulness where you play some nice music and you lie back in a chair and breathe, okay? And it's not talking about mindfulness where you just track whatever kind of thought is coming in your mind. Yeah, the mindfulness we're talking about is mindfulness that understands, yeah, that it investigates and understands something. And that then that mindfulness leads to wisdom. Okay. So, four Brahmaviharas are practiced in conjunction with mindfulness and are used to cultivate samadhi. Before meditating on them, it is necessary to shed animosity for others by seeing the danger of holding on to anger, hatred, and resentment. Okay, let's see. We should dwell on that sentence for the next 5 years. Huh? Okay. So we have to let go of our anger, hatred, and resentment. And hostility, you know, just, yeah, I don't like that person, get them away, I don't trust them. You know, this antipathy, yeah, that we have towards people. And, you know, on certain days, the antipathy comes very strong. On other days, it feels like, oh, I'm okay with everybody. And then all we need is a little bit of a bad mood. And boy, you know, then we're, you know, that person, look what they did. And this one and that one, who and ho. And, you know, we're judging everybody and nobody's good enough. And they're all, you know, a bunch of lazy bums. Yeah. Except us. Yeah. Yeah. Of course. Of course. Yeah. So, we have to do something with that mind, that, you know, judgmental mind that loves to pick faults, that is dissatisfied with what other people say or do or think. Okay. One thing that I find interesting is when I'm not happy with myself, when I don't feel good about myself, then I become very critical of other people. Yeah, when I don't feel good about myself, I don't feel good about other people either. Yeah, funny how that is, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, after all, it's all their fault. So why should I not feel good about myself? It starts with them, and then I don't feel good about myself. It doesn't start with me not feeling good about myself and therefore putting it out on them. Right? Hmm? Yeah? Think again. Okay. Okay. Recall that if these people were happy, they would act differently. People harm others because they were unhappy. Therefore, it makes sense to wish them to have a peaceful mind and good circumstances in their lives. Not that that would ever satisfy everybody. Yeah. But, you know, for our mind that instantly goes to, I want to make them suffer and get even. You know, to pause that and think, okay, they're unhappy, they're confused, that's why they're doing what they're doing. Yeah, they're controlled by their own afflicted mind. So rather than be mad at the person, you know, dislike the afflicted mind and wish that that person be free from it. Yeah, so this is how I practice with a lot of people in our government right now. Yeah, and I find it very, very helpful, you know. And also realizing that whatever good thing I wish for them, it's not going to satisfy them. Yeah, because in samsara, we're never satisfied. Yeah, you have power and you always want more power. You are successful in your policies and you want to be more successful in more policies. You prove that you're good and you want to prove that you're even better. Yeah. So I can see that in myself. That's the same thing in the people that I disapprove of, yeah, whose behavior I find abominable. You know, to talk about the behavior, yeah, the behavior is abominable, but the sentient being has Buddha nature. Yeah, the sentient being is not evil. So this is really, really important, you know, because it's so easy when you're dealing with somebody who has a problem, you know, when they're behaving in some who knows whatever way, to say, this person, something's wrong with them, they're doing this, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And as Shantideva points out, they're actually under the influence of their afflictions. We should be angry at the afflictions and want to get rid of those, not at the sentient being who is suffering from them. Yeah. It's hard for us to remember when people hurt us, yeah, that it's because they're suffering from afflictions. It's not that, you know, if you really think about it, I don't think people really in their hearts want to hurt others. It's when their mind is under the influence of, you know, some powerful affliction, and then they think that taking it out on someone else is going to alleviate their own pain, which it doesn't, yeah, but they think it will. And so they're so trapped by their own afflictions. Yeah. And that's not a reason for me to feel superior to them, because I am just as afflicted as everybody else and just as trapped by my afflictions. And so, of course, I can write treatises about everybody else's afflictions and what they should do to correct them. But what I really need to do is look at my own afflictions and work on them, because that's the only thing that I can really change. Yeah. Otherwise, what are you going to do? Put everybody else in chains? Yeah, so they don't do anything that bother you, except then they're going to scream and clamor their chains around. What are you going to do? Put duct tape on their mouth? You know, then they have to eat. You have to take the duct tape off and you have to put it back on again. It's going to cause you a lot of problems. Yeah. So, yeah, it's interesting how our mind works. You know, something's happening that we don't like and we just like, why can't this just stop? Yeah, I just want it to stop. Can't that person stop doing this? Are we saying, can't that person stop doing this? Or can't I stop being intolerant? Can't I stop being fearful? Can't I stop being judgmental? Yeah, not that we just let other people's atrocities go, or even they aren't atrocities, they're just small non-virtues. Not that we have to let everything go, you know, but to really think, you know, what is causing me pain? Is it what they're doing, or is it my berserking mind that just goes bonkers when somebody does something I don't like? Yeah. And when I invoke that, you know, that I invoke my own version of ICE, you know, in my heart. You know, okay, ICE, go out and get that person, you know, knock them down. Yeah, tie their hands behind their back, drag them in. We're going to detain them and we're going to deport them. Yeah. And, you know, forget due diligence. No, not due diligence. What's it called?
Process.
What?
Process.
Due process. Forget due process. You know, they are guilty. So, you know, I'm just going to arrest. You know, we have our own ICE in our own mind, you know. Kind of, yeah, go out and get that. I controlled myself. I didn't call him up. You know. Yeah. But, you know, it's a twofold thing. They're doing something, and my mind is flipping out. Yeah. We always go, they're doing something. But we can't stop them from doing it. We can try and influence. We can do what we can to help or whatever. But, you know, what Shantideva said, put on your shoes, and that way you don't have to put asphalt all over the rest of the world. Yeah. So, you know, if we can work with our own intolerance, boy, wouldn't that be an advancement? Yeah. You know, to control our freak out mind of like, I can't stand this anymore. Yeah, that's an interesting state, isn't it? Yeah, I think everybody's been in that state sometime or another where you're just screaming, I can't stand this anymore. Just like your mom and dad used to, you know, when all the kids were like bouncing off the walls and throwing things and behaving. I can't stand this anymore. Yeah. It's an interesting state of mind, isn't it? When we get like that, we're frozen. We're frozen. We can't do anything except sit there and scream. Yeah? I mean, what else do you do when you get like that? This has got to stop! You know, you should be going, oh, dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee, and you're going, stop! Yeah, so that's what you need to do, is stop the stop. And, you know, Omar Pasan, the dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee, yeah? And pull out chapter 6. Shantideva is our best friend. He doesn't always tell us what we want to hear, but he's always looking out for our benefit. And if we follow his advice, yeah, we'll be able to endure some of those things that we thought we could never endure. Right? Someday, that Tanka's going to talk. You know, in Tibet, there's different statues and Tonkas that talked. Yeah. So I think Shantideva and Jisungkhapa, you know, they have a lot to say. So, yeah, talk to us. And then we have to listen. Okay. So we've gotten through one paragraph. Love is the wish for sentient beings to have happiness and its causes. Sounds simple. It's not. Before beginning, consider what happiness is and what the actual causes for happiness are. Okay. Now, we've done, I think, some discussion groups on sharing the Dharma Day, you know, on this. And I think it would be good to do more discussion groups on this. What actually is happiness? How do you know when you're happy? What is it? Yeah. And then when you kind of can get some feeling about that, yeah, you start saying, oh, well, I'm happy after I have had fresh blueberry muffins. Okay, what is that happiness like? How do you know you're happy when you just had something you like? I just had the hottest chili peppers. Oh, I loved it. Yeah. What does that happiness feel like? How do you know it's happiness? Yeah. And then when you get some feeling about that, which actually is not so easy, yeah, then what is the cause of that happiness? You know, and it's not the chili peppers. Yeah, chili peppers are the cooperative condition. Yeah, if you ever want to shut me up, just give me chili peppers. Some of you like chili peppers, you know, that's fine. Yeah, I turn into a dragon. Yeah, everything's flaming from the chili. Okay, so... yeah, so what's the cause? Is the chili the cause of the happiness if you're somebody who likes chili? You know, the Buddha wouldn't say the chili's the cause of the happiness because every time you eat chili, you're not automatically happy. Yeah, when you first wake up in the morning and take some chili, those of you who like chili... No, that's not going to work. It doesn't always cause happiness. You know, what does the Buddha say is the cause of happiness? Virtue. Virtue. Then you have to look, okay, today did I create any virtue? I got my body into the hall. Is that virtuous? Well, it's better than it being somewhere else. But it depends on what I'm thinking once the body's in the hall. Yeah. What was I thinking today? What was I aspiring for today? Was I just aspiring to get through my daily commitments as fast as I can so I could go do something more interesting? Shanti Deva, what do you think about that? Yeah. You have some embarrassment, yeah. Okay, so to really think, you know, what's the cause of, what does it mean to be happy and what causes that? Yeah. And do we really believe that virtue is virtuous actions, virtuous karma is the cause of happiness? Or does every time we do something virtuous, we're sitting there, okay, where's the payment? You know, I want some happiness now. Yeah. Okay. So happiness does not refer exclusively to the feeling of security brought about by external objects, possessions, reputation, family, and so on. Okay. Well, for some people, you know, it is the feeling of security. But for some people who have security, they take it so much for granted that when you say, what's the cause of your happiness, they wouldn't say, oh, I live in a place without war. Yeah. Or I get along with my neighbors and I'm not afraid of any of the neighbors. Yeah, they wouldn't say that. Okay, so happiness does not refer exclusively to the feeling of security brought about by external objects, but rather to a sense of peaceful well-being and contentment in any circumstance. Oh, peaceful well-being and contentment, that sounds so boring. Yeah. Just sitting there, being peaceful, content. Nothing to look forward to, nothing to get jazzed up about, nothing to daydream about that is going to lift my mood and take me to la-la land. Just to be peaceful and content. Yeah, is that the way you react to those words? Yes, no, some people are saying no, some people are saying yes. Yeah, yeah. Peaceful and content, just, ugh. No, you want some excitement. Yeah, we want some excitement. You want to be on, you know, some talk show. Yeah, tell the world what you think. You want to build a Buddha hall so you can, you know, have another project that you can succeed at doing. You want to learn to speak Swahili because nobody else knows how to. And you heard that they have secret Dharma teachings already in Swahili and you want to translate them. Yeah? You want some excitement in your life. Yeah? Like, let's get a new car. You don't look excited by that. Yeah, some people. No. Isn't that exciting to you? If you need a car. Okay. Let's get a new... What?
Cat.
Cat! The old cats aren't good enough for you?
More is better.
Yeah, more is better. Okay, well, all of our other kitties basically chose us in one way or another. Yeah, so you just have to put out the choose us vibe. Yeah, and make sure it's a nice cat that gets along with all the human beings and all the other cats. Yeah, and doesn't chase gophers or eat stink bugs, you know. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we have criteria for our cats. Yeah. If you want to be a monastic at the Abbey, there's criteria. If you want to be a cat at the Abbey, there's criteria. Yeah. You have to put your paw print and say that you're going to be a good kitty. Okay. So happiness refers to a sense of peaceful well-being and contentment in any circumstance. That means even when you don't get what you want. Can you be peaceful and content and happy when you don't get what you want? When people don't do what you want them to do or don't stop doing what you don't want them to do? No. Okay, we have some work to do, huh? Okay, so think about what happiness is, what the causes of happiness are. Then generate a sense of love, metta or maitri, for yourself, wishing yourself happiness and its causes. Okay, so here, you know, wishing yourself happiness and its causes. Yes, you know, live in a nice place and a good climate and blah, blah. But remember, that's not the real happiness. Yeah, wish yourself Dharma happiness. Aspire to have realizations of the path. Yeah. And the causes, you know, aspire to generate the causes of those realizations. The causes, aspire to have peaceful contentment even when you don't get your way. And then what are the causes for that? Yeah, so wish that on ourselves. Yeah. So wishing ourselves happiness and its causes, it does not mean that we indulge ourselves with everything we want. Yeah. I once gave a talk, and, you know, that somebody came up to me afterwards and said, you know, I've spent my whole life taking care of other people and taking care of the family, and I'm tired of it, and I'm going to the shopping center. I'm going to buy myself a present. You know, and they really thought that, you know, buying themselves a present would make them feel better. You know, it didn't. Yeah. But to see if what we do, yeah, when we may not buy ourselves a present, we may eat, you know, 5 pounds of chocolate instead. You know, who knows what we'll do when... Yeah, we all have our own little way of when we feel restless and out of sorts. Yeah. Okay, so generate the sense of love for yourself, wishing yourself happiness and its causes. For some people, this comes easily, but others must first let go of feelings of unworthiness by contemplating that each and every sentient being is worthy of happiness. This can be a sticking point for some people. Some people don't feel, at least at some times during their life, that they are worthy of happiness. You know, look at how I've behaved, you know, I feel so awful for what I've done. You know, I don't deserve to be happy. That kind of thing. So, you know, this whole thing of self-hatred, self-criticism, being super hard on ourselves, often for things that are not that significant. And even if it is for big boo-boos or big unkindnesses that we inflicted on others, there's ways to purify those. But we haven't purified. We so far have sat there and just felt guilty and rotten and undeserving. Okay? This is exactly why the Buddha taught purification practices and practices to create merit. Yeah? When you purify, you put it all out there and you wash it away. You cleanse it. You make amends in one way or another. Yeah. And when you create merit, then you feel good about yourself. Yeah. Because you had a virtuous mind. When we have a virtuous mind, we feel good about ourselves. Okay. So there are antidotes to that. But what so often happens with people is, you know, we get stuck in, you know, I'm just a hopeless mess. You know, and I'm not worthy of anything except blah, 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 blah. Okay. So we have to recognize that state of mind is a wrong conception. Okay. This is where your low-rig studies come in. Yeah. People say, how do I relate all the philosophical studies to my life? This is one way. You look at your thoughts and you assess, you step back and you assess, is this thought true? Is this thought realistic? Yeah, I'm not worthy of happiness. Huh? Who said? Why not? Yeah, what trip am I putting on myself? And I got to stop that trip. Hmm? Okay. So for some people, they have to first let go of feelings of unworthiness. What? By doing what? By contemplating that each and every sentient being is worthy of happiness. Simply by the fact that they're a sentient being that wants to have happiness. That's good enough. You know, you're a sentient being. You want happiness. You have the Buddha nature. Yeah, sure, you can have happiness. So wish yourself to have the requisites for life, and especially wish yourself to have the happiness that comes through mental transformation and Dharma practice. Yeah, so wish yourself to have a peaceful, content mind that loves learning the Dharma, that loves practicing. Yeah. On this basis, now extend love to someone you respect. So you start out with yourself. The next person you go to is somebody that you respect. Okay, so this is, you know, Buddhaghosa, what he's saying. And he doesn't say, oh, the next person you wish love for is somebody that you're very close to. No, because there's often a lot of attachment for that person. So we have to discriminate attachment to love. So it isn't, you know, oh, I love all the people who are my family. I love all the benefactors. I love the people who praise me. I love my friends. No, Buddhaghosa said, no, start with somebody who you respect. Yeah, where there's not that sticky attachment, but you respect them, and then wish that person to have happiness in its causes. Okay, when it's stable, wishing that to somebody you respect, then you can go and extend it to friends and family. But don't start out with friends and family. Is this making some sense to you? Yeah, because it's too easy to fall into attachment. Yeah. Okay. And then, so somebody, yourself, somebody you respect, friends and family, and then continue by extending love to people towards whom you feel neutral. Okay. Now you have to ask yourself, who do you feel neutral for? Or do, as soon as you see somebody, you start putting them in friends and enemies category? Yeah. When you watch the news and you see what, you know, these people wearing masks, when big uniforms with lots of guns and apparatus attached on them, and they're throwing people to the ground or hauling people out of their, breaking their window and hauling them out of their cars. Yeah, they're strangers. Do you feel neutral towards them? No. Actually, we don't feel neutral towards their actions. Yeah, because it's the actions that we don't like. If we could take those actions away and meet those people in different circumstances, we might actually like them. Mm-hmm. Okay, so continue by extending love to people towards whom you feel neutral. You know, similarly, if you're in an airport and you walk past someone and you see somebody who's very attractive according to your criteria, it's like, do you still feel neutral? No, you want to go and talk to them. Yeah. So even though they may be strangers, they want happiness with the same intensity that you do. Yeah, so really try and keep the neutral thing, you know, the guys at the people at the grocery store, the people at the gas station, yeah, the people at Amazon customer service when they send you the wrong thing, you know? Yeah, to remember they want happiness with the same intensity that we do. It's not that we want happiness more than anybody else wants happiness. Yeah. When that feeling is stable, think of people with whom you have a contentious relationship where there is conflict or distrust. Yeah. As your love becomes more powerful, radiated outward to include more and more beings. Finally, spread love to all sentient beings in all directions and realms. Okay, so people whom we have a contentious relationship with, I would just prefer not to see them, not to talk to them, not to have them in my life. And so if they live on the other side of the world and promise never to come near me, yeah, then I can wish them happiness. Yeah. Aren't we great people? We're so tolerant and magnanimous and caring about others. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So really try and work with those relationships and see if there's specific things, specific behaviors that set you off in other people. If there's certain kinds of people that you don't like or certain behaviors they do that you just can't stand. Yeah. Look and look for patterns like that. And then see if that really is what is bothering you, you know? Like people who burp out loud. Yeah. And some cultures, people burp out loud. Yeah. Lama Zopa, we were in a retreat at Vajrapani. Yeah. And there was a certain group of students, a certain ethnic group, where you know, it's perfectly fine to let out a big belch. Yeah. Blah, you know. And so every afternoon session, you know, one, then the next, then the next. And they didn't think anything of it. It was perfectly acceptable in their culture. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? If it's acceptable in your culture, you don't mind if people do it. Yeah. If it's not acceptable in your culture, like Tibetans, you know. I mean, they don't do it so much now, but when I first came, you know, people always sticking their tongue out and slurping. I can't do it. Yeah, anyway, you know, but that's how they show that they like you. Yeah, and that they want to help. So, yeah. Okay. So, you know, it's not in our culture, yeah. But we do things that equally they don't like, you know. I think I told you about how when you blow your nose, I mean, they're changing now. But when I first came along, every time you blew your nose, you had to cover your head with your Zen or your Chogo. And if you have allergies like I did at that time, you spend half your life under your Chogo. Yeah? But that's considered polite. So it's interesting how these things of politeness can really mean a lot to us at certain times. Yeah? Some small behavior that somebody else doesn't think anything of, we just go, oh, that's so rude. It's so disgusting. Yeah? So again, that's our mind, isn't it? Yeah? Our rules of the universe. Yeah? No one can belch. Period. Unless you go somewhere far away from me, and then you can belt and fart. And yeah, but not near me. Okay, those are my rules of the universe. Yeah, but I can do those things. Yeah, and you just have to endure them. Okay. And so then from you have love for those people, and then you start really spreading it out to encompass. You start going, you know, different continents and different directions. Then think beyond our Earth, because our Earth is one little tiny speck of dust. You know, how many, when you look at night out at the stars, do you ever think of how many sentient beings there are out there? That what looks like this little star is some humongous star that is spreading light in their own solar system. And what kind of beings live there? Yeah. What do those beings look like? Well, how do they live? And do you ever, this is really something I think that is very healthy for our mind. It totally pulls us out of our own, you know, you look in space and there's so many sentient beings out there and each of them are having their own individual, unique experience, even if they're in the same realm. Yeah. And there they are, just doing what they're doing, trying to be happy. All the pretas running around, trying to get food. Yeah. Now, you know what our cats like look like when it's dinner time. Okay, that's nothing compared to the pretas running around, looking for food. And then getting to it, and it vanishes, or it turns into poop, or even they manage to get a little bit in their mouth, it burns all the way down. You think you get heartburn? Acid reflex or whatever it is? Whoa, and what those pretas get, and they just keep running around. They're so hungry. Yeah. And yeah, and then you look at Kshitigarbha. Yeah. Kshitigarbha voluntarily goes to the hell realms. Yeah. Now, we might think, ooh, I don't want to go to the hell worms. It's going to hurt there. Yeah. Kshitigarbha doesn't think about how much being in the hell realms is going to hurt him. Okay. What Kshitigarbha is concerned with is how do I lead the beings in the hell realm to purify non-virtue and create virtue? How are you going to do that with beings who are burning in fire, who are shivering in ice, who, even they're not doing that, whose minds are just overwhelmed by hatred and suspicion and paranoia? How are you going to help those sentient beings? Yeah. And Kshitigarbha says, I'm going to do it. Wow. Wow. I mean, when I think of that, it's like, wow. It's hard enough. How do you lead human beings? Yeah, that's hard enough. But beings in the hell realms who don't have any free time, how are you going to help them? And yet he voluntarily is there. Okay. So, you know, when we're generating love, you want to take it also to the hell realms, the hungry ghost realms. Yeah. Whatever animals that you see that it really pains you to see what, you know, their situation. One time I was traveling in India, going from Dharamsala down to Delhi, and we stopped at, you know, at the near Tulukpur for tea. Okay. And so I take a little walk, and there were some road workers that were, you know, had been paving the road around there. And I walk back a little bit. And there was a dog that had fallen in the hot tar. Oh. Yeah. And it was just lying there, sometimes squealing, sometimes just lying there in such incredible pain. And there was nothing I could do. Yeah. So you know, how do you generate love at that moment, you know? Or how do you prevent your mind from getting angry at the people who just left the tar around and didn't, you know, keep the dogs away or you know, or whatever it was, yeah? And just think, you know, sentient beings have so many different experiences right now. Yeah. Okay. So finally, spread love to all sentient beings in all directions and all realms. When barriers to extending love to the five groups, okay, so the five groups you focus on, yourself, the respected person, friends, neutral people, and hostile people. Okay, those five. So when barriers to extending love to the five groups have been broken down, what are our barriers? Intolerance, laziness, we don't have enough energy, we don't want to wish them well, they haven't earned it by our standards, whatever it is. Or somebody's got to love me first. Yeah, I want to love the world, but first somebody's got to love me first. Come on, world. Yeah. So when these barriers have been broken down and you are able to radiate love equally to all five groups, simultaneously the counterpart sign appears and access concentration is attained. Okay. So isn't that interesting? You know, you got over all those barriers and that's when you're able to make progress. So Bhikkhu Bodhi, I asked him about this. So this is 89. He said, it seems that when using this meditation, the counterpart sign as described in relation to casino, the counterpart sign is described in relation to casino meditation and anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, does not appear. The counterpart side is described in relation to kasina meditation and anapanasati, but it does not appear, okay? Some meditators, because they're talking about kasina and mindfulness of the breath, then you get the nimitta, okay? Some meditators who use metta bhavana, meditation on love, have told me that they do perceive the colored nimitta. But it seems to me that if one switches from love to the colored nimitta, one is no longer practicing metta bhavana, but kasina meditation, using a mentally perceived form as the object. Yeah. Because I had that question, you know, and he seems to have the same doubt that I do, yeah. Because, you know, as the Theravada position looks at it, when you're in dhyana, you're only on that one object, yeah. You don't go to any other, if you go to any other object, you're out of the dhyana stage. We're going to come to a part where there's, he talks about it, like if you want to involve insight meditation, yeah, then let's say you're in the first dhyana, you can't do insight meditation, let's say, thinking about your own impermanence or thinking about emptiness, unless that was your initial object of concentration. So they say you have to come out of your concentration. Your mind still has that feeling from it, that leftover feel. What do you call it? Yeah, like a leftover feeling, a Yeah, like when you're drunk and then hangover, the hangover feeling of love. Yeah. And then you then turn your mind to analyze, let's say, the impermanent nature of the mind that was in the first dhyana, yeah, that you just came out of, or the emptiness of the mind in the dhyana, but that you have to come out of it, they say. Okay. So Bhikkhu Bodhi seems to have some questions about this. I do too. Yeah. One way it makes sense, but in another way, anyway. Okay. Okay. So when you ate, according here to what Buddhaghosa said, when you can radiate love equally to all five groups of people, simultaneously the counterpart sign appears and access concentration is attained. Okay. Continuing to meditate, attain the full concentration of the first dhyana by developing and repeatedly practicing that same sign. Okay. Now the sign, I wonder, you know, could be just the feeling of love. Yeah. And that's your meditation object that you put your mind on. Okay. So you have to develop it and repeat it. So it isn't like you know, okay, now I got serenity. Okay. Yeah. Then next meditation, first dhyana, then meditation session after that, second one, you know, as if all you have to do is just sit down and in, you know, 1.5 seconds, you're going to be back in that same meditation state as you were at the end of the last session. You know, you came out, you had a break. Yeah. Your mind may have gotten somewhat influenced by the things or people you encountered in the break. When you sit down, you have to, you know, renew your concentration, you know, think of the object again, focus on it, you know. So it's very much a thing of practice. Yeah. Because we hear, oh, you attain serenity. Okay, I got that. Been there, done there, got the t-shirt, now, you know, full charge ahead. Okay. When you think of how many eons we've been distracted, do we think that, you know, 10 minutes of abiding in samadhi is going to counteract all the distraction tendencies? Okay. So continuing to meditate, attain the full concentration of the first dhyana by developing and repeatedly practicing that same sign. In the first dhyana, the five hindrances have been suppressed. And the five, so we remember the five hindrances, right? There are good friends, constant companions. We hang out with them a lot and they hinder our lives. Okay, but they've been suppressed. And the five factors, investigation, which some people translate as applied thought, and analysis is the second one, what some people call sustained thought. I think investigation and analysis are good enough translations. Joy, bliss, and one-pointedness. So those five are present in the first dhyana. With the attainment of the first dhyana, a practitioner also attains the liberation of mind and the liberation of mind with love. Okay? Because when you're single-pointed on love, your mind is liberated from hostility. Okay? So they actually have a title for that. Yeah. The liberation of mind with love. Okay. As meditation continues, the second and third dhyanas in the fourfold scheme will be attained. So you keep meditating, and over time, then the level of your concentration bumps up. Okay, so that's with love. Yeah. Next one, compassion, karuna. So compassion is wishing beings to be free from suffering or dukkha, okay, and its causes. So here's where I think we really have to use the term dukkha, not suffering. Yeah, because if we just think of ouch, suffering, then we're not going to really be able to generate full compassion, because that compassion has to include, you know, the suffering of change, and then the pervasive conditioned suffering. Yeah. Yeah, that comes up in what we chant on Wednesdays, doesn't it? Yeah, so pay attention to that. Okay. So reflect on the three kinds of dukkha. The dukkha of pain, which all sentient beings know, yeah, I want to be free of. The dukkha of change, that if you do something pleasurable long enough, it becomes painful. And even if it doesn't become painful, it stops. It's impermanent. Okay, and then the third, the pervasive dukkha of conditioning. Okay, I put a footnote in here too. Yes, look at samsara, nirvana, and Buddha nature for about the three kinds of dukkha. Okay, and wish yourself to be free of them. Okay? So here too, with compassion, you start with yourself, thinking of the three kinds of dukkha, and really wish yourself to be free. You know, I mean, I think that is really the meaning of compassion for yourselves. You know, we don't want ourselves to suffer in samsara anymore. Yeah. That's also renunciation, not wanting ourselves to suffer in samsara. Okay, then gradually increase the scope of your compassion to include dear ones, strangers, and people you don't like, and wish them to be free of all dukkha whatsoever. Yeah. So if we're holding grudges towards people, we're going to have to really spend some time on generating compassion instead, because grudge holding wants them to suffer. It's like, oh, I want to get even. Then they'll understand how I felt and how hurt I was by what they did. You know, they're going to give them, they'll have a taste of their own medicine. And then they will feel really sorry for what they did to me. Those, I almost said the word again. Yeah. So we have to do something with that mind that wants revenge. Yeah. Okay, so that's compassion, the second one. Then empathic joy, mudita. Yeah, you have to practice empathic joy with our mudita, don't you? Yeah. When she does something good, yeah, you rejoice. Yeah. She's getting better, isn't she? Yeah. Oh, you're holding back. Well, maybe in some people's eyes she's getting better. No, she's changed a lot from when she first turned up and was hiding under our doorstep. Yeah, she hid under the front doorstep and wouldn't come out until, at that time, Venerable Yeshe enticed her out and smothered her with love, and she got integrated in the community. Okay, so develop empathic joy. Begin with a dear person or a cat, followed by a neutral person and then a hostile one. Okay, contemplate the goodness they have in their lives and have a sense of abundance. Yeah, so again, it's easier to do with people that we have a positive feeling towards. Oh, they have so many good opportunities. They do so many things well. I'm glad. I feel very happy. Yeah, but then other people, Oh, why did they get that opportunity? It's not fair. I should be recognized for this, not them. Okay, it becomes harder with those people. It becomes harder when our mind becomes tight like that. Okay, so with empathic joy, contemplate the goodness they have in their lives and have a sense of abundance. Yeah, when you have a sense of abundance, there's a real feeling of joy in the mind. Yeah. Rejoice in their good fortune and rejoice in the merit that caused it. Wish them not to be parted from this well-being, not by their possessively clinging to it, but by joyously appreciating it. So really wish them well. You know, they have happiness. We didn't even have to do anything to make them happy. Yeah? You know, we, the bodhisattva wannabes who are willing to go to hell for the benefit of one sentient being, so we say every day, you know, here's some sentient being who has some little bit of happiness. Yeah? Can we really rejoice that they have it? Yeah. Then recollect that other beings who are currently experiencing good fortune and feel happy for them, rejoice that they have goodness in their lives and rejoice in their virtuous activities. Okay, so, you know, sometimes people leave the community and there's a feeling of sorrow. Yeah. Sometimes maybe a little bit of anger. We don't understand what they're doing. But can we step back and just say, you know, and wish them well, may they have happiness. And if they're going and doing something that's virtuous, rejoice in their virtue. You know, people don't, you know, we don't have to say, well, I'm sorry, they only can convert, they only can create virtue here. I don't allow them to create virtue anywhere else. I don't rejoice at the virtue they create with another group or with another teacher or by doing some other something. You know, they have to create virtue the way I want them to, with the people I want them to. Yeah. You can see how our mind just, boy, we create so much of our own unhappiness. Okay, so rejoice that they have goodness in their lives and rejoice in their virtuous activities. Let go of any sense of jealousy or competition that wants to deprive them of the causes of well-being. Okay, so rejoicing is the antidote to jealousy. Yeah. Lama Zopa, whenever we would do the seven limb prayer, he would pause after the fourth line, you know, where we rejoice at the merit of ordinary and holy beings and at any good circumstance anybody has. Yeah. And I often wonder why Rinpoche did that. Is it because so many of his disciples were jealous of each other? There was a lot of jealousy and competition. Yeah? You would think, oh, no, they're all Dharma practitioners. They wish each other well. Well, on one level. Yeah. But, yeah, why do they get to go in Rinpoche's room and practice with Rinpoche when he's guiding a meditation with just two or three other people? Why do they get to go and I don't? Yeah. Why do they get to travel with the teacher? Yeah. And I don't. Why do they know Tibetan and I don't? Yeah. Why? Yeah. Why does the cat like them and doesn't get pay any attention to me? Oh, I go away for 6 weeks and Maitri doesn't speak to me, you know, when I come back. She favors Venerable Semkhe. And even she favors Venerable you, who you didn't like cats.
That's not true. They just made me sneeze.
Oh, you liked when they made you sneeze.
No,
so you didn't like cats. Yeah. But now, yeah, you and Maitri are friends, and she sits on your bed. Yeah. And I just go off and try and benefit some human beings, and the cat's mad at me. Okay. Yeah. I mean, we get jealous over amazing things, don't we? Yeah. The things we get jealous of. Oh, somebody's a quarter of an inch taller than me. Yeah. Somebody weighs, yeah, 5 pounds more than me. Or 5 pounds less than me. Or, you know, they can do the dishes so fast. Yeah, when we work in the kitchen, they just zip through them, and I'm just sitting there, you know, slugging along, being the last one to finish washing the last dish. We're so competitive. Yeah. I want to be the fastest dishwasher. Yeah. What do you call that? I want to be the yenta of the community. Okay. Now, yentas are not just matchmakers. Yentas know everybody's business. Yeah. Yentas know what's going on with you and what's going on with you and what's going on between the two of you and how about the three of you. Yentas know everything. Okay. Yeah. You know I can't tell you. Yeah. Talk to the yenta. She told me. Yeah. But yeah, and you know, we want to be the busybody and know what everybody's doing more than anybody else knows what's doing. Yeah, what's going on with different people. Okay, so we get jealous. Okay. So let go of any sense of jealousy or competition that wants to deprive them of the causes of well-being. Instead, have the sincere wish that everybody not be separated from abundance, well-being, and excellent opportunities. Here, too, include yourself, rejoicing at your own good fortune and virtue. Yeah. So this is something to think about, you know, to really rejoice when people have, when they're happy. Yeah. Trump just got the Nobel Peace Prize. Did you see the picture of him with him holding it? Yeah. The Nobel Committee didn't give it to him. They gave it to Machado, the one dissident from Venezuela. Yeah. And Trump complained. That's why he wanted to take over. He wrote on Truth Social, yeah, he wrote a note to the Prime Minister of Norway, addressing him by his first name, Dear Johannes. Yeah, Johannes. Your country decided not to give me the Nobel Peace Prize after I have stopped 8 wars plus even more than that. So I don't feel any obligation to have work for peace.
What?
Yes, you can go online and read this, you know. And so that's when he said he's going to take Greenland, you know, either the easy way or the hard way if they don't give it to him. Yeah? Okay. So how did we get on that? Okay. So this guy, when she gave him, you know, her Nobel Peace Prize, but the committee said you cannot give away the Nobel Peace Prize. You know, they decide who gets it. You can give away the money, you can give away the medal, but you're still the one who got the Peace Prize. Okay, so the Nobel Committee said that. Okay, yeah. But she, you know, still gave him, you know, some big thing, you know, written out with the medal, and he's sitting there, standing there next to her with this smile like you have never seen Donnie smile before. He was the happiest guy alive, you know, just beaming like this, you know. Yeah, can we rejoice that that poor man felt one instant of happiness in his life over this? It's really rather pathetic, isn't it, when you think about it? Yeah. We're the same way, though. Yeah. We're the same way. Let me get the opportunity, not that guy. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Equanimity. Upekkha. Okay. Upekkha is explained differently in various contexts. Okay. Yeah. So it's one word that there's many different definitions for in many different contexts that it is used. Okay. In the Pali tradition, in this context, it refers to a sense of acceptance about what is and is not possible. Okay. So you're accepting what is possible and you're accepting what is not possible. Okay. Is that easy? Are we equanimous about those two things? No. Yeah, we're accepting of what is possible as long as it's something we want, we get it. Yeah, we are not accepting of things that are not possible, even if it's something we think that we deserve or we want or it should be. Yeah, but this is a feeling of equanimity, you know. You're able to look at a situation and, you know, yes, it's possible for Donnie to get the Nobel Peace Prize. It's not possible for me to get the Nobel Peace Prize. That's okay. Yeah? But we don't accept things when it's not something we want. Yeah? Even if it's not possible, we will fight against it. It should be possible. Yeah, it should be. I should be able to hit the ball over the net. I should be able to paint well. Yeah. But if you look at how I hit balls, if you look at how I paint, it's really not so possible. Yeah. Can you be equanimous about that when you think like you should be able to do something or you think a situation should be a certain way? Everybody should appreciate what I've done, you know, and they don't. They complain. Yeah. Well, it's just not possible. But it should be possible. Okay. So equanimity refers to a sense of acceptance about what is and is not possible. To cultivate it, reflect on the difficult and painful things in your life that haven't yet been resolved. Okay, this is a good one for healing stuff. Consider that these circumstances came into being as a result of karma, your own actions. Karma is real and powerful. Once karmic seeds have ripened, we cannot unripen them. We can't go back in time. We must accept the situation, stop fighting the reality of what is happening, and cultivate fortitude and equanimity. This will make the mind strong and prevent becoming bitter about life. Not so easy when it's something where you have a really strong idea of how things should be. Yeah, they should be paying attention to climate change. What is this stuff about at Davos? They're not talking much about climate change. They should be. It's a danger to everybody, to the planet, to all life on this planet. They should, but they're not. Yeah. Can we have some equanimity about that? Well, it is possible that they talk about it. They talked about it last year at the Davos meeting. Why not this year? Well, the causes aren't there for them to talk about it much this year. One or two people want to, but Trump has taken over and the falling apart of NATO is what's on people's minds now. Yeah. So even though we think it should be possible, it isn't possible at this time. They're not the causes and the conditions. Okay, so we have to cultivate fortitude and equanimity. Equanimity, accepting the situation. Yeah. This will make the mind strong and prevent becoming bitter about life. When we reject reality, you know, our mind is weak and we easily become quite bitter. After cultivating equanimity for yourself, gradually extend it to others. When spreading equanimity to dear ones, strangers, and people you don't like, and all beings, recall that beings fare according to their karma. Although you may want to help them, sometimes their situation is such that you are unable to help because of the strength of their karma or because they are not receptive at this moment. This is what Kashiti Garba puts up with. He's trying day and night to help all those beings in the hell realms, but their karma's pretty strong. They can't accept it. And they're not open to any kind of Dharma remedies that he wants to teach them because they're too angry about being in so much pain. Okay. So this is the time where equanimity is so important. You try and help, and the person can't take it in, or the karma's too heavy, or our ability to express the help wasn't very tactful or was misunderstood. And it's hard to have some equanimity there. Okay, so abide in equanimity and don't suffer unnecessarily, thinking that you should be able to fix their problem. Yeah. Save yourself a lot of tsuris. You know what tsuris is? It's Yiddish for pain and problems. Yeah. I learned all these, you know, very useful words in Yiddish without even trying. Okay. So don't think you should be able to fix their problems. Keep your heart open to them. But realize that just as you can't always resolve all of your own dilemmas caused by your karma, neither can you resolve others' difficulties. Isn't that true? We can't resolve our own stuff, let alone others. Breaking down the barriers between oneself and the neutral person, the dear person, and the hostile person, are as above in the meditations on love, compassion, and joy. So too is cultivating and repeatedly practicing the sign. Through this, one enters the fourth dhyana. Okay? So you enter the first through love, second dhyana through compassion, third through mudita, empathic joy, and fourth through equanimity. A meditator can gain the fourth dhyana only on the basis of having attained the third by means of meditation on one of the other immeasurables. Yeah, so you have to, at some, to get to the fourth equanimity, you have to be able to break down the barriers regarding all sentient beings, either in love, compassion, or empathic joy. In other words, only after attaining the first, second, and third dhyanas on love, compassion, and empathic joy can a meditator attain the fourth dhyana on equanimity. Okay. So serenity can be cultivated with any of the four Brahma Viharas, beginning with love. You can abide in them with access, concentration, or absorption into one of the dhyanas. The liberation of mind by love refers to dhyana absorption on love. The four Brahma Viharas, when perfected to the state of dhyana, are liberations of mind in that they are free from the five hindrances and the gross negativities of body, speech, and mind. Okay, wouldn't that be nice? Free of five the hindrances and gross physical, verbal, and mental negativities. They are also free from confines because love, compassion, joy, and equanimity are radiated in all directions. The expansive karmic result of these liberations of mind overpowers the negative karmic influence of the limited karma of the desire realm. That's why you get bumped up into the dhyanas. All four Brahma Viharas are liberated from hostility and malice. Specifically, love has the remarkable ability to liberate the mind from malice. Compassion has the remarkable ability to liberate the mind from vexation or frustration, being fed up. Yeah. Joy has the remarkable ability to liberate the mind from discontent, and equanimity liberates the mind from attachment to how we want things to be. These four liberations of mind weaken the fetters and lead meditators to becoming non-returners. Yeah? So once combined with the awakening factors, the 37 awakening factors, those concentrations lead to final liberation from samsara. Okay? So the reflections, let's just read them. So first, this is your homework. Reflect on the various types of happiness, physical, mental, spiritual, and their external and internal causes, and generate love, the wish that all beings have these. Two, releasing all thoughts of unworthiness. Respectfully wish yourself to have happiness and its causes. Imagine your healthy needs being fulfilled, not your unreasonable needs. Imagine your unreasonable needs being vanished. Okay, spread this love to those you respect. When this is stable, gradually spread love to friends, strangers, and people you don't get along with. And then extend love to all beings in all realms of existence, focusing on that experience of love, develop concentration. So those are the steps with love. Then you can do those five steps to develop compassion, then to develop joy, then to develop equanimity. Uh, Okay. Yes.
I have so many questions. I'll start with one. I was a bit confused when it said that Axis concentration is attained when one is able to radiate love equally to all five. And I think this is because we've been hearing the teachings from the Sanskrit tradition as well as in Thursday. When I think about attaining a certain level like Axis concentration, I'm thinking in terms of stability and clarity.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like saying, okay, if you can radiate love to all, that seems more of an aspect of the object in a way, like what my love is, rather than an aspect of like stability or clarity of the mind.
The mind of love. Mm-hmm. You want to generate the mind of love.
Mm-hmm.
That's a mind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not you're meditating on love. Oh, love is out there. Love, 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 love. It's right. Love is here.
Mm-hmm. But I guess there would still be different aspects of that love in terms of like who it encompasses or the strength of it. Those seem like it's different than talking about the stability or clarity of it. Is there
there's
any way
stability where you can keep your mind on it?
Mm-hmm.
And there's clarity because the feeling of love is very vivid in your mind.
So then the statement here about reaching Axis concentration is presupposing that one has that stability.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, for
that's,
sure.
That's what I was confused by.
For sure, yeah. I mean, it's not talking about generating love for all beings, you know, and it's off and on and off and on every 2 seconds. No, you're meditating on this and developing that quality in your own mind, making it stay. Otherwise, your mind isn't liberated. It isn't a mind liberated by love because, you know, you get angry in the next 2 seconds. Uh-huh.
Someone online is asking, is this the only way to attain the jhanas?
No.
To use the four brahma?
No. We just went through the 40 objects. There's many, many, many objects. And so before the previous time, we talked about what you do with the casinos, how you make the casinos and you put them up and so on. Here, it's talking about when you use any of the four immeasurables as objects, how to do it. Yeah. So it's just talking about different objects. Yeah. You can develop, concentration on impermanence, but there you don't just sit and say impermanence, impermanence. You have to do some analysis, reach a conclusion, you know, make it vivid, make it stable. Okay, so it's just talking about different objects, different ways. Yeah, that's why, you know, there was saying at the beginning, you know, there's 40 objects and you can decide together with your teacher about, you know, what object is going to suit you best. Yeah?
Someone just wants to clarify. They ask, does it mean one can't attain the fourth dhyana with the first three immeasurables?
How does that read? You might be able to. I don't know. Yeah, because here they're talking about it, especially with the fourth dhyana. A meditator can gain the fourth dhyana only, you know, if you're doing this meditation, only on the basis of having attained the third by means of meditation on one of the other immeasurables. So if you're aiming to attain the fourth dhyana on equanimity, you have to have attained any of the others on any of the other immeasurables, getting as far as the third. Now, can you get as far as the third with just equanimity? I don't know, you know? Can you get the fourth with any of the others? Yes, I think so. Yeah. I'm sorry if this is an important question that you need to know the answer of immediately because you are on the verge of getting serenity and you need to know what object it is. Ask somebody else. Okay. Anything else? Okay. So we will stop here and then resume next week from that point. So you have to realize, you know, when we're talking about serenity, it's, you know, and some of these higher practices, it's, you know, maybe not so easy to understand initially, you know. And a lot of them, it seems to me, you have to practice and have some experience to really understand. You know, like somebody could say, well, you know, I want to generate concentration on impermanence. Yeah, how do I do that? What does that feel like? If I have samadhi on impermanence, am I always afraid that everything's changing all the time? Am I happy it's changing all the time? Can I really have stability if the object is impermanence and the fact that things are changing all the time? You know, I think, you know, I mean, I can't answer those questions. It seems to me that you have to talk to somebody who has had that experience, or you have to get there and kind of see for yourself. Yeah. What our job is to work with the five hindrances. That is what our major block is the five hindrances. This is why we study the Lam Rim and the Lojong, the thought training, because that's what's going to help us deal with those. Yeah. So we have to really practice where we're at. Yeah. We can study what is more advanced, but recognize that we're probably not going to understand it perfectly and have all of our questions answered. Yeah. But we know what we need to do. Yeah. I guess it's like you want to become a rocket scientist and you have all these ideas. How does this work? What do I do with the engine here? How do I get the engine to stay in the rock sciences and the hoo-ha-ha? You know, and what do you have to do today? You have to learn calculus, you know? You know a little bit about the engines, but you get yourself all tangled up because you don't know the calculus that can calculate the speed depending on how much fuel is burning at what temperature for how long. Yeah. So you need your calculus and you don't have that. But you really want to know, you know, how this engine is going to work and get you to the moon. Yeah. Yeah. And then what are you going to do when you get to the moon? Yeah. What?
Take pictures.
Right. Yeah. Make sure you, yeah, yeah, with your selfie thing, you know, in your big bubbly thing, hold it out. Okay, let's dedicate.